friends, just before I begin, I want to congratulate the Dean, and it is true I have been in this pulpit before, on the choice of hymns. At least I don't know who it is who chose the hymns, but choosing hymns that Jews can sing and we don't have to expurgate is absolutely brilliant, and I love the hymns, so it's been wonderful so far. I'm sorry about the rest. We've just heard the famous story of the judgment of Solomon, the story designed to teach us both how wise he was, though he certainly made many mistakes in later life, and the news of the past week about sexual harassment certainly applies to Solomon. But also, and significantly for today, what terrific judgment he had in how he presented his conclusions. And we've heard how the book of 1 Kings recounts how Solomon prays for wisdom. And you've heard how God says to Solomon that because you've asked for this and not for long life or wealth or whatever, or the death of your enemies, he was going to get what he asked. And then later on in the same first book of Kings, the Hebrew Bible states, the whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. So Solomon's reputation as a judge was quite something. But what was meant by that kind of judgment? For the word judgment in Hebrew, mishpat, is one kind of judgment. But the other is fairness, tzedek, sometimes translated as charity, but more often as righteousness. The idea of tzedakah, charity, comes from the same Hebrew root, meaning not charity as Christians would understand it, but more like some kind of evening up operation. The obligation in Jewish law is to give 10% of one's income, which is, of course, where tithing comes from. It's called tzedakah, justice, or evening up. From medieval times on, we know charitable donations enabled community elders to provide a handout of food on a daily basis to the destitute, and dowries for poor girls so that they could get married. But interestingly, for those interested in legal philosophy, the moral obligation of giving charity is combined with an expectation from the poor in society that they will receive it. Chaim Cohn, former Israeli Attorney General, now alas long departed this life, made the excellent point that the duty to give tzedakah, the 10% of charitable obligation, implies a collateral right on the part of the poor to receive it. It's one of the ways he argues for the concept of human rights in Jewish law. The meek gratitude associated with some overly sentimentalized Victorian philanthropy is somewhat inclined to stick in the Jewish craw. I give simply because I have more than you and I can afford to. It's chance that I have more than you, and when I give it, it balances better the scales of social justice. It isn't something I do out of the incredible generosity of my spirit. And that, of course, ties in with the second reading today, the reading where Jesus quotes from the book of Leviticus in the Hebrew Bible, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," except in all the English translations, it's completely mistranslated. It actually says, "Ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha," you shall love your neighbor, he or indeed she, is just like you. Now, there's a great story by Israel Zangwill, who was a 19th century Anglo-Jewish novelist who used to hang around this area quite a lot. And it's called The King of Schnorrers. Schnorrer is the Yiddish word for beggar. But that English word doesn't quite encompass the way schnorrers work. One morning, a Jewish gentleman living in the West End was roused by a manservant who said that there was a very disreputable and obviously Jewish man at the front door. The Jewish gentleman went down to see who it was and found a schnorrer. "What are you doing here?" he asked. "Asking you for help, for money, so I've got somewhere to live. Why come this early and wake the whole household? Look, do I tell you how to run your business? So don't tell me how to run mine. No meek gratitude, just an assumption that the rich guy would give to that beggar because basically the beggar had a right to the money." And that attitude is combined with an emphasis on particular ways of giving. And the great Jewish teacher and philosopher Maimonides listed liberating the poor person from ever needing to ask again as the highest of his 8 orders of charity. Giving 10% of your income gave you no particular moral virtue. That was just a form of social taxation, but gave you the freedom to give it to who you liked. All that was enshrined in Jewish law and thought long before the concept of human rights. The supreme dignity of humanity, which is essential for a concept of human rights, is enshrined in early biblical texts. Tzedakah, donations are to be made to anyone, not only Jews, for need occurs irrespective of color, class, community, gender, whatever. Everyone is included. Now, you might say that human rights are becoming unfashionable in some sections of society, or at least the legislation and codification that enshrines them. But these ideas go back to the Hebrew Bible, though how they're formulated is clearly a political decision. The Declaration of Independence in the United States traces rights back to the divine. All men, they didn't mention women then, are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is in itself a bit of a peculiar statement, as that great American judge, Lew Pollack, observed. And he said, by tracing these rights to the Creator, and by characterizing them as unalienable, the Declaration gave important impetus to the principle, which also had its antecedents in Locke's writings, that some individual rights exist in perpetuity, apart from and above the laws periodically prescribed by particular kings and legislatures vested transiently with the power to govern. Very irritating for governments. And I speak as both a rabbi and a legislator. And this is the judge's service, and judges have to apply the law. But just think back. These ideas, sympathy for the oppressed, the need to ensure fair trials, the duty of the rich to help the poor and not oppress them, to open the blind eyes, to free the captive from his chains, were and are the meat of prophetic thought, the true social vision of biblical thinkers, and the antecedents of the social legislation, both of the rabbis and, of course, the teaching of Jesus. This is about religious duty, mitzvah, a positive commandment. These are the rules to live by. Similarly, the emphasis on fair trials and a proper judicial system first appears in prophetic writings as a general injunction, particularly in Isaiah's description of the ideal ruler. He will judge the poor with equity and decide justly for the lowly in the land. And this is further elaborated in Deuteronomy with the magnificent injunction based on the equality precepts so emphasized by the prophets. Hear the causes between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother, and the stranger that is with him. Ye shall not respect persons in judgment, but ye shall hear the small as well as the great. Ye shall not be afraid of the face of any man. Within this law-based system, there came a duty to do things for others which resulted in those others having an implied collateral right to receive it, be it the gleanings of the harvest or the protection from oppression. Stopping showing favor towards the rich and powerful led to a fair judicial system, to due process and equality before the law. That was true of Judaism as a whole, but it became the clarion call of early Reform Judaism and of the liberal universalist tradition. Now, there is a further question as to what extent it is within the prophetic and biblical tradition to campaign for further change in the law. Should you agree with Samuel Horsley, the Bishop of St. Asaph's in the 19th century, who once said in the House of Lords, "What have the people of England to do with laws except obey them?" You could argue, then, what have the judges to do except apply the law? But it isn't like that. Judges do not usually campaign for changes in the law, though retired judges certainly do. But they interpret the law, and at the most senior levels, by how they interpret present-day legislation, they arguably make law, much to the executive's irritation. Is that what Solomon was doing? Was he being wily in his judgment? Was he making law by choosing a new way of deciding on who was right and who was wrong? Is that a proper role for judges? It's hard to argue from the text we've been given that it isn't part of what judges do and indeed what they have to do. Sometimes judges argue that it isn't so. But when we look at these biblical texts and hear the story of Solomon and his judgment, we should be proud of our judicial system and of our judiciary. The story should make us proud of how our courts have fair process and how judges have remained independent. There should be no favour for the rich and famous, nor for the poor and destitute. There isn't, at the moment, fairness in access to justice. But once you get to our courts, you get a pretty good deal in this country. So think of Solomon and his great judgment, and celebrate the judges and what they can do. But also recognize, whatever politicians say and they do, that deep in these biblical books is the first spelling out of the idea of fair trials, proper courts, due process, and the rights of the poor. It isn't modern, newfangled stuff. It's right there, and the judges have a huge burden going back at least to 2,500 years of recognizing that and honoring it. Kein hi ratzon, may this be God's will, and may judges have courage and strength.